Wait a second. This isn't your grandma's cancer show.
Not your grandma's cancer show.
Hi, I'm Tatum Duroc, and today we are talking about gender and cancer. Like, most of us know, cancer, its treatment, all the hormone disruptions can really do a number on our sense of self. And to some degree, there's some support and treatments in place to restore a sense of femininity or masculinity, such as reconstructive surgery, HRT, you know, even those look good, feel better workshops. But what happens if you're non-binary, trans, or questioning? What if your care is set up to affirm a gender which isn't yours? I've got two great guests here with me today. Matt's been on the podcast before in our Lasting Effects episode, and they'll be sharing how their treatment for a brain tumour at 17 meant they were given testosterone, but what it's been like to refine themselves now. And Angie was diagnosed with breast cancer. Welcome to the podcast, Angie.
Thank you.
I'd love to ask, when did you first start thinking about gender and your gender and how you felt in yourself?
When I was very little, kind of before puberty, it was more about what other people expected from me as someone that was designated female. When I hit puberty, it was like, yeah, I don't like any of this. I don't like any of these changes and they don't feel right. It's kind of been a thing for a long time, but it also took a long time to have the right words to talk about it.
When you were accessing healthcare pre-cancer, were there any ways that being non-binary or that feeling of female not really fitting affected your healthcare choices or how you accessed?
Looking back, probably the main thing was taking hormonal contraception more as a means to kind of stop having periods than for the purposes of contraception. So I guess that was the main thing.
Did you look at breast reductions? Was that something that you had considered?
As far as I could see, I didn't meet the criteria to have it done on the NHS because although they're quite large, they weren't kind of causing me sufficient issues.
What was the speed like from the time that you were diagnosed to the time that you were in surgery?
So I got referred once by the GP once I found the lump, so that was about 2 weeks. And then mammograms and ultrasound and biopsy all on the one day at the clinic. And then it was about another 2 weeks to get the results. And then the surgery was, yeah, like a couple more weeks after that. So it was about, you know, from diagnosis to surgery, it was about like maybe 5 weeks or so.
In that time, did you get to speak to the surgeon about kind of some of your concerns about the surgery and what you would want?
The only option that they kind of gave was reconstruction. So I got like, you know, booklets and a talk with the cancer specialist nurse about kind of reconstruction and what the different types were and so on. That was it. And like I sort of did kind of vaguely think, well, you know, if I have to have one side removed, I'd rather have them both removed. I saw the surgeon at like my first appointment when I was having all the tests and then again at the second appointment for the results. But after that, unless you decided on reconstruction, you didn't see them again. But it also felt very much like, you know, having worked out what was wrong with me, they were like, okay, you're like going on this pathway that you're having this and that.
I almost imagine you a little bit like you're on a conveyor belt. There's something good about that speed, but also that it doesn't give you a lot of time to sort of regroup, make those decisions, think about, you know, how, you know, you want that surgery to be. And it sounds like the option to have a double mastectomy wasn't given to you.
After I'd had the surgery kind of recovered a bit, I did bring that up and they were like, oh, well, you know, you're not high enough risk for that. I'm like, okay, I do understand that. I mean, I work for the NHS as well. And, you know, I do understand that. It's like, you know, you've got standards of care and technically that would have been like a perfectly healthy body part that I'm asking you to remove. I found it very strange in some ways, because it's like, I can have reconstruction, you know, I could have had reconstruction. I could still say, oh, I've changed my mind and I want reconstruction, you know, and I would get put on a list for that. That's purely for psychological reasons, for people's well-being. You know, it doesn't affect your physical health. So I was kind of like, well, I don't understand why, if you're going to do that for psychological reasons, which, you know, I think is great, because a lot of people do need that. As I don't understand why, if you'll do the reconstruction for purely psychological reasons, that I can't have a mastectomy on the side that wasn't affected for essentially the same reasons. Doesn't seem to be something that's considered.
Yeah. You make a really great point there, that it is for someone's kind of symmetry, aesthetics, and also psychological, how they feel. And all of those things are just as valid if you're making a choice to be symmetrical with both breasts removed. That psychological and emotional and aesthetic and all of that is still there, but it's thinking that people might want something completely different. Take me to how you felt a couple of weeks after your first surgery.
I actually felt a lot more upset than I thought I would. And I felt, for the first few weeks, I kind of felt like I'd been mutilated. It didn't feel like my choice. Overall, yes, it was something that I wanted to have done. It was just kind of like the whole way it happened, and the fact that it didn't really feel like I had a lot of choice in the matter, or, you know, or even that I, you know, I'd had like particularly much explanation. You know, it's like, and again, I get it, you know, like cancer services are very busy, but it was sort of like, you know, we're going to do this, this and this. And they didn't really explain to you like what it would look like after the surgery. It was kind of like, okay, we're going to take this out, we're going to take that out. It wasn't any talk about how it might look or feel or even how you might want it to look. If I'd had reconstruction, like, there would definitely have been more of a conversation around aesthetics.
Oh, I mean, that feeling of a lack of choice and that feeling of mutilation, like when you said that, it's so, the impact of kind of how you recover when that's the way that you're feeling about it. A good experience can aid recovery, well-being, everything. And how an experience of not being really listened to, not being considered as an individual person, can then lead to, you know, not just neutral feelings, but feeling mutilated, and how that affects every part of how you think of your cancer and your recovery. Can you take me to how you felt after the second surgery?
Absolutely the opposite. I was so happy. You know, I keep kind of seeing myself in the mirror and smiling. It felt right. You know, I was like, yeah, this is, you know, this is actually what I want. This is how I wanted to feel. From the aesthetic point of view, because I had them done at separate times, kind of by different people and kind of for different purposes, it's sort of like the two sides don't quite match. But the surgeon who did the second one kind of made an effort to kind of even things out and make them look a bit more comparable, you know. So I'm very happy with it now. But yeah, there was kind of that period where I was like, well, I don't, you know, I don't kind of like this. And then it's like, it's also, especially if you have kind of quite large breasts, which I did, it's actually really hard when you've only got one. You know, it's kind of like, because kind of the weight of it just slides a bra around and it's really uncomfortable. You know, everything is lopsided and I keep leaning to one side without even, you know, even realizing. And I was just so happy to be kind of, A, to be symmetrical again, but just to also just have kind of that gone and just sort of to feel more comfortable in my body.
You know, I can see that expression all over your face. Like, there's literally a lightness when you talk about having the full surgery, having the double mastectomy, having it the way that you wanted it to be.
Yeah.
And that being your choice, and just what an impact that is. And I know that there was a process to get that second surgery.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what led you to being referred to the gender clinic?
Ultimately, it was the cancer diagnosis. So it was sort of in that period, sort of post-surgery and kind of just before I started chemo, that I kind of realized that, yeah, I definitely wanted to have the other side removed. At that point, I think there was like 12 to 18 month waiting list for the gender clinic. So I went to my GP and she was like, well, are you sure you want to be referred now? And I was like, yeah, because, you know, by the time they actually see me, I will have finished, you know, all my chemo and radiotherapy and everything. And I'm actually very glad I did get referred then, because the waiting list is, I think it's like more like 4 or 5 years now. Well, certainly I was hoping for, you know, like a good outcome from all my treatment, but you know, you never know. So it does sort of make you think, well, life is short. And I was like, well, you know, maybe I'm not going to be here kind of that many years from now, but I would like to spend those years kind of feeling more like myself.
I can hear in there that there's almost that confrontation of mortality was kind of an impetus of whatever time there is that you wanted to feel even more yourself. So how was it for you when you arrived at the gender clinic? Like, what did they offer you? And did they help with navigating that second surgery?
It was a little odd, because the first thing I had was they kind of had maybe 100 of us come for essentially like a day's worth or half a day's worth of lectures about what the various things that they offered. Because it's not just like surgery or hormones, they also offer kind of group therapy for different sort of groups, so like non-binary people or trans people, but they also had some for like people of color who are also trans and kind of things like that, and voice therapy. So they kind of went through all the things they offer and also a few things that they don't offer. It was actually really nice to kind of have that big group. So there was kind of like basically the whole range of adults there. We had all these presentations and they talked through like, you know, different types of surgery and so on. And then after that, it was kind of like, okay, go in and wait for like another 12 months till we give you an appointment with a psychiatrist. So like for me personally, because you see several different psychiatrists, I think I had to see 3 because they decided I had to see a third one because of being non-binary, which was annoying, but whatever. And endocrinologist. So the endocrinologist was lovely. And he really went through like all the options for hormones and kind of like what effects you would get, kind of what effects you wouldn't get. And kind of about the fact that some of them are reversible effects and some of them are not. The psychiatrists were variable. The first one I saw was kind of fine. The second one I saw actually really upset me. The whole way that she was with me, I kind of came off. That one was over Zoom because I think we were in COVID times by that point. And actually, I kind of came off that feeling really upset. It just kind of felt like maybe she didn't believe me or she didn't take me seriously or something. Like, it was just not a very nice experience. The last one that I saw, he was fine, except for because I was asking him to refer me for another surgery, not the mastectomy. And he was mostly fine. But then he said, but what if I refer you for this and you change your mind and I feel bad? And I just kind of looked at him because I was like, I don't even think that should be a part of your criteria. Like, you know, yes, I might change my mind, but anyone might change their mind. I mean, you know, people regret having like knee replacements or that kind of thing all the time. You know, no one goes around going, well, you shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't let people just have knee replacements. I don't understand why you're trying to hold, you know, my treatment hostage to the fact that you feel theoretically there's a small chance you might feel bad in the future. apart from the endocrinologist, I felt like with the psychiatrists, once you'd got over your initial hurdles of persuading them that you were actually trans or non-binary, they expected you to know what you wanted, or at least have some kind of an idea. It wasn't like, you know, which I guess was the point of the initial sort of lecture thing, is that you could spend the rest of your time waiting for an appointment, thinking about what your options were and what you might want. And so didn't feel like they were kind of particularly guiding. It was more that they were kind of going, okay, well, you know, you've persistently said that you want this thing and you seem to understand the implications. It kind of felt like that was more what they were doing. But as I said, the endocrinologist definitely felt like that was more of a collaborative kind of thing.
Thank you, Angie, for sharing that. So many ups and downs in there to kind of feeling part of something, having that kind of, almost a sense of camaraderie and connection. Yeah. To then also having, you know, with certain healthcare professionals, either a collaborative experience, such as with the endocrinologist, or feeling like you still have to make your case, that your choice might not just be valid, to meet some bar in their brain that actually isn't to do with you, which is... Yeah, it's really interesting. And I'd love to bring Matt into the conversation here. Matt, how has it been hearing from Angie?
Although it's obviously your story, Angie, I did feel very, very heard and very seen with that, because, yeah, incredibly relatable, actually. I think, like, particularly sort of not having the right words at the time to describe your own identity and how you feel. I think that was something I definitely faced, even like as a young teen, you know, and then like the conveyor belt of treatments and not being able to be, not being told or informed properly, or just not given the chance or space to ask questions. Yes, very seen. So yeah, thank you for sharing that.
So Matt, when you almost came out when you were 13, what was going on for you?
From like a very young age, I'd sort of like not even thought about it, but just sort of, I guess, you know, at the time it was sort of said, sort of cross-dressing, experimenting with clothes and sort of sneaking into my mum's room at times and trying different clothes on and stuff. Yeah, when I was 13, I'd learn, I think it was like an ethics class early on in secondary school, I'd learned that trans people, you know, were an actual demographic of people, not some demonized sort of label that you sort of heard about. That was my experience of transness beforehand, whereas having the ethics class and then being able to explore that afterwards. And I can remember being awake one night, and I spent a lot of, probably far too much time actually, before exams and before school, scrolling through different sort of compilations of early trans women after treatment. I can remember thinking I definitely identify as, like, at least trans. I would, you know, at the time I'd have probably said a trans woman had I known the terminology existed. But yeah, I decided when I was 13 that I was going to, for a long time I thought I was gay, and then I decided, no, I'm definitely trans, I think. So I decided I was going to come out, and I went downstairs from my room to the living room to tell my parents, and I walked into the room and really like sort of building myself up. And I remember one of them looked at me and said, well, like without any sort of warning, they just said, I'm so happy you're normal. Like, I'd love you no matter what, but I'm so happy you're sort of normal. And then... So, like, 13-year-old me immediately shut down, like, mentally,
yeah.
not going into transness anymore. So that sent me back a few years, but yeah.
Oh, I mean, that's so impactful. It was almost like they had an extra spidey sense that you were going to, what you were going to say, and kind of shutting that down, but also saying, I love you at the same time. There's so many confusing messages in there.
It was very confusing for me, and
yeah.
yeah, it definitely took a while to sort of recover from that, I think.
You didn't have a huge amount of time to recover from that because you hadn't even fully gone through your puberty when you had a brain tumour. And can you tell us a little bit about where your brain tumour is and how that affects your hormones?
Yeah, I was diagnosed at 17 in 2017. I was diagnosed with two brain tumours, one on my pituitary gland and one on my pineal gland. Pituitary gland obviously creates a lot of hormones, very necessary for going through puberty. When I was diagnosed at 17, I'd had symptoms for probably about sort of 3 or 4 years. So at that point, my pituitary gland was basically non-functioning. So I hadn't actually fully gone through puberty, so I'd got very little body hair. I had no facial hair, which I thought was brilliant. Sort of none of the sort of downsides of male puberty. So that was nice. But yeah, it really did mess a lot with the hormones. So,
and did you have any feminine traits at that point from not having those hormones?
I sort of inherited my bum a bit from my mum, but I was quite happy at that. 13. I remember being very envious of certain people at school. And because of not having sufficient hormones or working pituitary gland, when I did start going through puberty, the effects wore off quite quickly. So I very quickly started to gain quite a bit of weight. I was still a bit puzzled about this, but I didn't sort of have like male fat distribution, nor did I sort of have female fat distribution. So I sort of ended up with quite a big tummy, but not like a sort of what you'd kind of beer belly or anything. But I also ended up with what we nicely described in 2013 as moobs, man boobs. And I remember at the time being quite all right with that, because to me, I didn't realise, with not having a very good education in gender, I didn't realise that there were any different to like actual breast tissue. So I just thought I got boobs, which I was quite happy with. So there were a couple of like different slightly feminine things. But yeah.
As part of your treatments, did they put you on hormone replacement?
So I was put on quite a few different hormones and medications. The main hormone that I was put on was after I was put on sort of steroids and nasal sprays and like desmopressin and thyroxine to control sort of my underactive thyroid, I was placed on testosterone. But first as a gel, then an injection. And I was it wasn't long since I'd finished radiotherapy, and I was very ill for about a year after radiotherapy. I remember having one appointment before starting testosterone and just being told, it'll be really good for you. You know, you'll be able to like grow a beard. And at the time I really didn't want that, but I felt so ill and so vulnerable that saying that to my endocrinologist at the time was a professor who also like worked on different boards all around the country and spoke around the world. So like his position of power compared to mine at the time, I felt totally unable to say anything against it, but I thought he must know what he's doing. And I did, for a little bit, feel better with more energy. But seeing that sort of facial hair develop really hit me. I was just had in the back of my head that, oh, I can just stop testosterone and these effects will go back, because nothing like that was ever explained to me. So I think when I found out like sort of testosterone, some of the effects like facial hair, different, so the effects to my skin wouldn't go away, I think that really sort of really hit me.
And you found a really good therapist. Can you tell us a little bit about how that was and how you found them and what you gained from that?
I worked with an amazing therapist from September last year to just before Christmas. I'd been struggling since sort of starting university in 2021. I'd been struggling a bit with mental health. I think because it was sort of re-going through sort of trauma and sort of rediscovery of myself. I said, I have a year out. I'm going to go through therapy, and I was waiting for an appointment with the University Mental Health Service. And I had an email from them one day, which I totally missed, with an appointment. So then I had to wait another couple of weeks, which was great because I ended up with another therapist, a non-binary therapist who was wonderful. And they basically, I was unable to talk about anything. I couldn't say the word sex without going, sex, you know, saying everything super quietly, like whispering. They were really like totally unbiased, just said, encouraged me to explore myself, my identity, helped me work through different bits of trauma. A couple appointments, you know, I walked in, I never would have imagined this, but I walked in, you know, like all sort of what you call women's clothes, big air quotes for clothes. And being able to walk into an appointment in clothes that made me feel happy and to have someone validate me and say, you know, that's totally fine. That was massive. So yeah, it was really, really good to have such an amazing therapist. So
So glad. And can you tell me a bit about when you did the Shine Instagram takeover?
I think it was after the podcast I was on before. I had sort of had an email about it, and I think the day before it was, or a couple of days before it would have been scheduled, I quickly sent an email into Shine saying, I think I can do it. I think I've got like some spare hours I'd be able to. So it was on a really busy day. So I tried to plan some posts beforehand, and it was about sort of long lasting effects of cancer and treatment. And I ran through my different medications that I have in the morning and how they affect me. I went through sort of fatigue, anxiety, bits of all sorts of different things, and even like skincare routines. And then it got to sort of the end of the day. I think it was probably about 8 p.m., 9 p.m. and I was absolutely shattered. I thought, I'd been debating all day, and I thought, I'm just going to make a post about being trans and having cancer just to see if there's anyone else sort of like me, because I hadn't sort of met anyone sort of who'd dealt with sort of similar things. And I put two big posts on, running through my experiences, having not great endocrinologists, and thinking it'd get a couple of likes, not many. And then it didn't go viral or anything, but out of all the posts of the day, I think my highest amount of likes was about 30. The trans cancer one had 70, and it had all these different comments from people saying, I never thought I'd met anyone with similar story, being trans and having cancer. It was really validating, and to hear that, it sort of inspired me to sort of like carry on sharing my story. It was super hard for me to sort of navigate things alone. So I think if there are other people who can benefit from hearing about my struggles, my journey, I think that'd be great.
Oh, I'm so glad. And, you know, at Shine, like, really want everything that we do to be inclusive, so everyone can come along. And that's the thing. And then you end up finding other people that have similar things and similar considerations. And I love that you felt so validated and heard, and also other people got to connect with you on that day. Thank you, Matt.
No, you're welcome.
Angie, how's it felt to hear from Matt?
Well, I think a lot like Matt was saying, my story felt validating. I had some of the same effect. I mean, again, obviously, specifics are different, but that story about coming down to come out to your family and hearing something that just shut you down. And yeah, I've had that experience, like, you know, and it's just that thing where people are like, you know, why aren't people just more open? It's like, I was going to be open, and then I heard you say something that made me think that you weren't a safe person to tell. So I didn't. Like, it really resonated, but also it feels like one of those things where you need to think about how maybe what you're saying might affect people you know, because you don't actually have someone, even someone you've known a long time, you don't know everything about them. You know, there might be something, you know, big, like they're trans or they're gay or whatever, that they haven't felt able to share with you, or that they're still working out. Yeah, and then you saying, you know, like a casual, what to use a casual remark, might absolutely just shut them down kind of for a long time.
Yeah, and I'm really thinking about that in terms of healthcare settings, and that really casual remark of, oh, this is great, you'll get to grow a full beard, you know, oh, we're going to leave this surgery so you have the option of reconstruction, without taking on board who they're talking to. And actually, when you presume like that, then you shut down that conversation before it's even had a chance to happen. And Matt, you so perfectly articulated that power imbalance when you're sick, when you're scared. And Angie, that speed, you're still getting your head around being diagnosed. Let's go to Matt first. What would have helped in terms of, you know, a doctor being sort of open, and is there anything that they could have said that would have allowed you the space to say, actually, I'm not sure about testosterone?
It's difficult because obviously I'm an endocrinologist and just want to balance chemicals and, you know, wipe the hands and that's it. But I think, and I did put this on the post on Instagram for Shine, but I put that really it's just like I've had to go on a really long road of self-acceptance before diagnosis and another one after diagnosis. If someone had just talked with me and actually spoke about sort of what was going to happen to my body, to sort of say, would you like to speak to a psychologist, a counsellor beforehand, then I think that would have saved me years of trouble, because I could have gone through that self-discovery years ago. Instead, I've had to go through it myself at quite a lot of the points, and I've had to go through it with the help of others. So I think if it's just like talking, being open, I know there's not a lot of resources to go around in the NHS, but I think if there is, if we're going to be so keen on going through months and months of referrals and therapy and counselling for people who go to gender clinics, then I think they should be the same for anyone who has to go on like artificial hormones, at least at check-in appointment, just to make sure that they definitely want this, away from that sort of massive power imbalance. So
yeah, because, you know, I know that you've told me that going on testosterone was a fairly straightforward, not even thought about, you know, here it is, this is what you should take. But coming off testosterone, that was a whole rigmarole, and being questioned about it, and, you know, sort of having to prove that, you know, it wasn't for you, and there were sort of checks and balances in place. Whereas actually, if a few of those check-ins were done before any HRT, any hormone replacement, that could make such a big difference. It would at least give the space for that to be considered. Angie, what would have made things better for you?
Similar to Matt, definitely not slowing down the process, because obviously there are very good reasons for not doing that. But, you know, like maybe instead of, you know, it's like the current process, which was, you know, find the symptom, go to your GP, GP sends you to the hospital, you know, the hospital does tests, and then you come back a few weeks later for the tests and they tell you what's going to happen next. You know, maybe in there could be space for someone to just, and again, I know mental health resources are not huge for the NHS, unfortunately, but someone to just reach out and be like, how are you? Are you doing okay? Is there anything that you want to bring up that you haven't been able to bring up so far? Because of the whole speed of everything, and because it felt like having found like the type of cancer that I had, they just kind of go, okay, well, you know, the best treatment for that, according to the research, is XYZ. So it's like, okay, you're on the XYZ pathway. And there were only like a very few things that they considered as options, which apart from the reconstruction, I think the only other two things they asked me about was, one was before chemo, if I wanted to preserve any eggs. And the other one was whether or not I wanted to do the cold cap thing to try and keep my hair. Like, I wasn't interested in any of those. But obviously, you know, that's different from person to person. But it was kind of like, looking back, it's like, okay, so there's certain things where you think, oh, this is something that is aesthetic, but that we have thought, oh, this does will affect people. They might, it might bother them, or, you know, we want to give them the chance to have children in the future if they can, you know, if they want to. Then it's just like other things that you don't consider at all, because I've met, as well as, you know, other trans people with cancer, but also like cis women who had breast cancer, who had a single mastectomy, who would have liked to have had both removed. Yeah, but couldn't, because again, they didn't have, I think it's normally only people with the BRCA mutation, that thing where they just think, oh, there's only certain things that you'll care about. You won't care about how kind of your scars look or the shape of you. Like I said, after my first surgery, like obviously the surgeon was aiming to get rid of the tumor and make sure he didn't leave anything behind, but it was just like, it was really ugly. I had like a massive dog ear where my horizontal and vertical incisions joined, and it was kind of lumpy and weird looking. And it was just like, not only is it kind of had to get used to having this thing done that I didn't want to have done in that way, but also the way it physically looks. Having a big dog ear is actually kind of uncomfortable because it sort of rubs on your clothes, or your clothes rub on it, I guess. You know, maybe broaden your ideas of what people might want, or just actually like ask them. I mean,
yeah,
it didn't feel like there was a fact. The only thing I got asked at my diagnosis appointment, which I was actually quite annoyed about afterwards, was I came in and the surgeon said to me, so what do you think the results are? You know, and I said to him, well, I don't think they're good, because I'd had an appointment for a CT scan. And because I work in healthcare, I was like, well, I know that's not a good sign. But I was just like, what do you expect me to say? What if I say, oh, I think it's great? And then you're like, well, actually, you have like a really aggressive cancer. I mean, that's not how you should be breaking bad news to me.
Nope. The things that get said sometimes. But yeah. What I loved that you said was ask. Like, sometimes it's just as simple as that. Like, just putting assumptions to the side and just asking. And for both of you, I can see what a big difference it is, you know, getting to have your treatment reflect how you feel as a person. If someone is out there listening to this and they'd love like a resource of where to go, or an organization that helps with like being, you know, trans and having cancer, is there anywhere that you would point them towards?
I'd say Shine is a bit of a soft plug, but yeah, I think Shine's been really useful for me to be able to just sort of almost like have a space to explore myself away from sort of the rest of my life. And I will just say, the Yorkshire Group's being founded and we're going to be incredibly inclusive. I'm one of the leaders.
So, excellent.
Hop over to the Yorkshire Group. Oh. But yeah, I'd say Shine, 100%. Yeah,
lovely. And Chi, do you have somewhere?
If you wanted something that was like more specifically like trans or LGBTQ, there's Live Through This, which is like a sort of peer support group, which is, I think it's mostly online at the moment.
Yeah, they've changed their name now to Outpatients, founded by Stuart O'Callaghan, who's been on the podcast several times. Yeah, they're brilliant. I'm so glad that they're there and there's even more specific support. Thank you to both of you for being such wonderful guests. It's been really, really lovely. And I'm so glad, like I said, that you're both, Matt, exploring and having a space to do that in and feeling more yourself. And Angie, I'm so glad when you talked about looking at yourself in the mirror and just like smiling, like, yes, that's what we want to be able to feel when we look at ourselves. So thank you to both of you for sharing that. Thank you to all of you listening. And if you enjoyed this today, you know, send us a like, send us a comment, subscribe. Come along to Shine, shinecancersupport.org.
Yeah, sure.
And thank you to the always awesome radio facilities for sponsoring our podcast. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Angie. Till next time. Bye.
Not Your Grandma's Cancer Show.